You know, there are behaviors that people show and there are statements that people make. And if you don't know the context, then sometimes things can seem kind of out of character. I may have told you before about the time when my daughter was 9 or 10 years old. We were in a restaurant together and I knocked over a drink and she said, "Look what you did, you little jerk." And she did not get in trouble for that. I did not ground her for that. We both got a laugh out of that. Now, don't get mad at me. I'm just going to tell you, last week, Gail was going to go to the post office for me and mail something, and so I was handing her a $5 bill, and I said, "Keep the change, you filthy animal." And she did not punch me in the mouth. She actually laughed about that. Now, the reason those two terrible statements were funny is because they are quotes from the movie Home Alone, one of our family's favorite movies. And so when you know the context, you know that Mackenzie was not being disrespectful. She normally would not have called me, to my face at least, a little jerk. But she said that to me, quoting that movie, and we both thought it was hilarious. When I gave Gail the money, if I called her a filthy animal on a regular basis, she would punch me in the mouth, right? But I'm just saying, I was quoting that movie. She got it. We thought it was funny. Because context is important, okay? We're going to see Jesus today, and he's going to be doing some things that seem totally out of character for him. We talk about Jesus being the good shepherd and the gentle shepherd. We talk about him being kind and compassionate, our friend. And then he goes and he does something like this, and you start to think, wow, did he just snap? Was it too much pressure? I mean, what pushed him over the edge like this? But when we know the context, we begin to understand that he's doing exactly what needed to be done, and maybe doing the most kind and compassionate thing that he could have done under the circumstances. So let me give you the context of what's happening in this story for today, and we're going to read it from Mark chapter 11, beginning in verse 15. On reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple area, and he began driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those who were selling doves, and he would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. And as he taught them, he said, "Is it not written, 'My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations,' but you have made it a den of robbers?" And the chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this, and they began to look for a way to kill him, for they feared him, because the crowd was amazed at his teaching. Okay, it's Monday morning of Jesus' final week of ministry. The day before, he had ridden triumphantly into Jerusalem. The crowds waving palm branches, they're calling him the king. It was just a big party in their minds on Sunday. Here it is, it's the next morning, he storms into the temple and he starts flipping tables, right? Well, I mean, what's this all about? And truthfully, why does it matter 2,000 years later? Well, I'm glad you asked. In fact, I'm going to ask you a question in just a few minutes that literally could chart the course for the rest of your life. Okay, hang on. We'll get to that in a few minutes. Now, we're in this series that I'm calling Call of Duty. We're looking at Jesus' final week of ministry. I mean, from Palm Sunday until Easter Sunday, all kinds of incredible things happened. And Jesus' life reminds us that sometimes the right thing to do is the hardest thing to do. But Jesus just kept doing his duty, no matter how difficult it was, how overwhelming it was. And it kind of reminds us that we need to do the same thing. Now, we saw last week that Jesus showed compassion at the triumphal entry. I mean, he wept over Jerusalem because he knew the reality of what was going to happen to these people because they had refused to recognize who he was. And we said last week that we need to look at people through the lens of Jesus, that we need to see people from Jesus' perspective. And that's how we build compassion. Now, today I want to take a closer look at this cleansing of the temple. Ken Geyer is one of my favorite authors, and he wrote about the contrast between Sunday and Monday of the final week. He said how different Jesus is here than when he came to Jerusalem riding the colt of a donkey. How soft-spoken he was then, how outspoken now. He entered the city with the meekness of a lamb. He enters the temple with the ferociousness of a lion. His teeth are bared, claws extended, roaring his rebuke. He said, "You've made my father's house into a den of thieves." Now, when I was growing up, the church where I went had a rule. Well, truthfully, we had a lot of rules. Some of them made perfect sense. Others of them were kind of confusing to me. And this rule was one of the confusing ones. We had a rule that whenever a singing group came to sing at our church, or a guest preacher came and maybe he had written a book, the singing groups and the preachers could not sell CDs or books in the main building of our church. Now, they could sell them in the church's gym across the parking lot, but they couldn't sell them in the main building. Oh, heck, who am I kidding? I'm old. They weren't selling CDs. They were selling cassettes. But anyway, you get the idea, okay? They had music that they were offering, maybe 8 tracks. I don't know. Anyway, I went from records to cassettes. I skipped the whole 8-track world. But anyway, all right, so that was the rule when I was a kid. And the reason they could not sell anything in the building was because of our text for this morning. It seems like, Mark was saying in his gospel here, that Jesus was mad because the people were selling things. Well, sort of, but that's really not exactly what's going on here. And so I want to show you a little more about this text. We're going to dig in a little bit, and then I'm going to try to help you understand why I believe this is important for our lives today. And then I'll ask you that question I was telling you about that's going to change your life. Okay, we'll get to that in a minute. Now, before we get to the selling part, there's some things we need to talk about regarding the temple itself. You need to understand, in Jesus' day, the temple was not just one big, large meeting room. Okay, there were different areas, different courts of the temple where different groups were allowed to worship. The outermost area of the temple was the court of the Gentiles. Anybody, Jews, Gentiles, the Gentiles are non-Jews, anybody could go through that part of the temple. Now, Gentiles could not go farther in than that. If they did, they'd be put to death. So you might say this was kind of a big deal. Okay, they could not go any farther than this part of the temple. Next came the court of the women, and Jewish women could go in there. They could not go farther in unless they were bringing an animal for sacrifice. Then you have the court of the Israelites, where the Jewish men would gather to worship. Then came the court of the priests, where the religious leaders would worship and where they did the sacrifices. And then the innermost part of the temple was the Holy of Holies. This is the place that represented the presence of God. Now, we know God is omnipresent. He's everywhere at once. But this Holy of Holies represented God's home. This is where God lived. And so nobody could go in there except the high priest, and only one time a year on the Day of Atonement. Very special place. So in our text for this morning, this market had been set up in the court of the Gentiles, the outermost area of the temple. What was supposed to be a place of prayer and worship for the Gentile believers, and really for all nations, it had become this center of activity. Now, what type of market was it? Well, there were money changers in there. See, foreigners who had come to Jerusalem to worship had brought Roman money with them, and they had to exchange it for Jewish currency so they could pay the temple tax. So these money changers set up tables, and then they would charge ridiculous fees to exchange money there. Now, still further, they were selling animals that were suitable for sacrifice in the court of the Gentiles. Now, animals could be purchased outside. The problem was there were these inspectors on the inside, and a lot of times they didn't like the outside animals, so they'd find something wrong with the outside animals because they wanted you to buy their stuff on the inside. It's kind of like when you go to the movie theater and you're not supposed to bring in outside food and drinks. I know sometimes you do. Okay, I know what you do. But I'm just saying, the rule is you're not supposed to bring in outside food and drinks because they want you to buy their food and drinks, right? And just like the movie theater, the religious leaders were jacking the prices up and kind of ripping everybody off. And that's what's so sickening about this, is that they're supposed to be providing this service for their people, and instead they're ripping everybody off, okay? And they're charging these ridiculous fees just like the popcorn and candy. What's supposed to be a place of prayer and a place of worship for Gentile believers had become a zoo. I mean, really, literally, it was a zoo in there. It would be like me trying to preach a sermon and or maybe the worship team is leading a song and you've got Sherry Reed and Leslie Fleckler selling t-shirts up and down the aisles, right, while we're trying. Now, the t-shirts are still for sale, but after church, okay? You can't buy them right now, okay? I'm just saying, you know, that little commercial break there. But we're not hawking shirts or beer and popcorn right up and down the aisles during the service, all right? It's different. It would be like the youth group is offering donkey rides and free kittens during communion. You know, it's just a little distracting, right? You don't do that during the service itself. Inside the court of the Gentiles, this place where people were coming to connect with God, it was just a crazy mess. Can you imagine trying to teach a Bible lesson and you got cows mooing and doves cooing and you got goats and sheep doing their thing and you got somebody over here saying, oh, we got two pigeons for a dollar, and you got somebody over here saying money back guarantee on all livestock, and then you have the booth that's selling MLTs, you know, mutton, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches where the mutton's really lean. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. It was crazy in the temple. And you're thinking, okay, Mark, you made your point. We got it. But why does this matter? We don't even have a temple anymore. That's fair. I want you to understand, first of all, that Jesus wasn't mad because they were exchanging money or because they were providing animals for sacrifices. Those services were needed. He was mad because they were disrupting worship to do it, and he was mad because they were ripping people off in the process. He called their market a den of thieves. This was a con. They created a monopoly, and then they jacked the prices up so they could make more money off of everybody. So really, the singing groups that came to my church could have sold tapes in the foyer of the sanctuary, and they could have sold books there, and Jesus wouldn't have been mad. Now, according to my recollection, based on some of the quality of music and price of the cassettes, Jesus might have flipped over some tables, I'm just saying. But in general, they could have done that. Now, to top all of this off, just to, for clarity's sake, there's corruption in the temple. Yes, that was going on. We also need to understand that the church building today is not the temple like it was in Jesus' day. Those are two totally different things. See, back in Jesus' day, the temple literally represented the place where God lives. But God doesn't live in temples anymore. Acts 17:24, the Apostle Paul said, "The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth. He does not live in temples built by hands." You know, there is a temple today, and it's not on the place in Jerusalem where the mosque is now. You know what the temple is today? 1 Corinthians 3:16 makes it very clear. Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's Spirit lives in you? See, when my church growing up didn't let us sell things in the main building, they meant well, but I think they were missing the point. The church building is not the temple. We're the temple. We are where God lives. Selling wasn't the problem in Jesus' day. It was robbing people blind and disrupting worship. That was the problem. So what did Jesus do? He fixed the problem. He took matters into his own hands. He flipped tables. Try exchanging money now. And then he drove out the animals. And then he said, no more of this. And he kept people from bringing merchandise into the temple courts. Market day is over. The flea market is closed. And he cleaned house. Now, there's something else you need to understand about all this. Yes, Jesus was mad. I mean, he was mad. He was angry that the temple had become so corrupt. But Jesus was not out of control. Okay, he wasn't behaving irrationally. He hadn't lost his mind. I think this is interesting. Mark's the only one of the Gospels that points this out. It's in Mark chapter 11, verse 11. Jesus entered Jerusalem, and he went to the temple, and he looked around at everything. But since it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. See, that was Palm Sunday night. That was the Sunday evening. He had ridden into Jerusalem, you know, on the donkey and out of the crowds, Palm Sunday, all that. Then he went into the temple. He looked around. He saw the mess. He saw the corruption. He saw the abuse. And he went home to Bethany and he slept on it. And he kind of pondered what to do. And the next morning he had a plan and he came in and he did it. He was out of patience, but he was not out of control. Now, what shocks me about this is that Jesus did all this and nobody tried to stop him. I mean, the religious leaders were mad about it, but he came in, he took charge, and he kicked tail, right? And they didn't stop him. It amazes me that nobody tried to detain him. They didn't kick him out of the temple, right? And I'm not even sure why. Maybe it was because the crowds respected him so much from the day before and the whole "you're the king" thing. Maybe it's just because there was something about him, so much authority, that people just backed up when he made decisions. But nobody threw him out. Nobody even tried to. He brought prayer back into his Father's house. And I just think this story is one more glimpse at the sheer courage of Jesus and this profound authority that he showed during his final week of ministry. All right, now I want you to think about this. We think about how bad the condition was in the temple and the big mess that it had become, and you wonder, how did things get so bad? I mean, seriously, how did it get so bad? I mean, temple worship in the Old Testament wasn't always good. There were whole generations that let the temple fall into disrepair. But think about when Solomon built the temple, and then when Ezra and the people rebuilt the temple later. I mean, man, the whole purpose was to honor God and to praise Him, and people came from everywhere. This was the center of the world, spiritually speaking. And now, in Jesus' day, these guys, they're doing everything but worshiping. I mean, how did things get so bad? I'm guessing one little step at a time. Things did not get like this overnight. You know, one day somebody had the bright idea, you know, if we set up a table and we offered money exchange here, think how much easier that would be for everybody who comes, and then all of a sudden it's like the New York Stock Exchange in there. Maybe one day somebody said, you know what, so many pilgrims come from far away for this. If we brought a few of our extra doves, maybe we could sell some doves and help the people out, and all of a sudden it's like Noah's Ark. But it was a process that got them there. Day by day, step by step, corruption kind of wormed its way into the house of God. And here's where the message starts to get practical. What do we say the temple of God is today? It's not the church building. It's us, right? How does a person's life go from good to bad today? How does a committed husband and father run off with his secretary? How does a faithful man of God end up with a full-blown porn addiction? How does a godly preacher, like a friend of mine up north, start out taking painkillers and end up nearly dying from a heroin addiction and is in prison today? How does a woman of faith abandon Jesus and join a cult? How does a Christian teenager go off to college and end up denying the existence of God? It doesn't happen overnight. It's usually a series of small choices. It's minor indulgences. It's unwise decisions. Oh, just once won't hurt. Yeah, give me another one. I can handle it. No one will ever know. And one day you look in the mirror and you don't even recognize yourself anymore. Remember that song Casting Crowns sung, Slow Fade? Little daily choices. Nothing overnight, nothing big. And people fake it for a while, don't they? People come to church every Sunday, man, they sing all the songs and they give the money and they pray the prayers. They might even preach the sermons, but their heart's going in the completely opposite direction of where it needs to be. And it's why the question that I'm going to ask you in just a minute is so important. See, in the Old Testament, King David wrote this. He said in Psalm 139, 23, search me, O God, know my heart, test me, and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me and lead me in the way everlasting. That is a sobering prayer. I mean, that's a scary prayer. God, search me, know my heart, test me. If there's anything in me that's going in the wrong direction, help me to get back on the right path. David is asking God to probe into his very soul. Let's face it, sometimes it's really hard to know a person's heart. The secret sins, the hidden thoughts, the questionable motives. It's not always easy to kind of peel back all of those layers and see the core of a person, even if that person is you. It's just hard sometimes. We deceive ourselves. And it's why this question that I'm going to ask you is so pivotal. Here you go. You ready? Here's the question. What's in your closet? Seriously, what's in your closet? Now, not what's in your wallet. Okay, that's the whole Capital One commercial. That's about credit cards, which, by the way, the commercials got a lot better when they put, Jennifer Garner in there instead of Alec Baldwin and Samuel L. Jackson. That's just my opinion. But anyway, that's not the point. It's not what's in your wallet. It is what is in your closet. What are you trying to hide? What are you trying to ignore? What do you wish you could cover up? What do you wish you could forget? Maybe it's something from the past that just still haunts you today. Right? I mean, it's been forgiven, it's been forgotten, at least by God, not by you. You can't seem to do that. You can't let it go. Maybe it's just ruining your life. Maybe it's damaging your relationships. Maybe you just can't have any peace of mind. There's this shame, and there's this regret, and it's just too much to bear. It's in your closet. Maybe what's in your closet is right there in the front of your mind. It's printed right there on your bank statement. Maybe it's in your computer. Maybe it's on your calendar, and I'm talking about not the calendar back there, but the calendar that's coming up, and you got it all marked out. You're ready to go. Maybe your life is plagued by secrets that are corrupting your spirit. Like that temple in Jerusalem, it's become a den of thieves. Maybe your closet is leading you farther and farther away from God, and it's just sucking the life out of you. Jesus came to deal with your closet and with mine. He came to clean up the mess that was in there and to lead us into a new course for the future. What did he do to make things better at the temple? Well, he did several things. First of all, he did an honest evaluation of what was going on, right? He didn't just listen to rumors. He didn't just make assumptions. He went to the temple. He looked around. He assessed the mess. And then he took inventory. He slept on it. And he went in and did something about it. So think about your life. Think about your closet. I mean, what are you hiding in there? I'm serious. What past regrets or what secret sins are choking your spirit? You've got to name it before you can fix it. You've got to take inventory before you can make changes. Now, this inventory might be as simple as praying for wisdom and doing an honest self-evaluation. It might be as complex as working with a counselor or maybe, you know, checking yourself into a rehab center. The more extreme the problem, the more extreme the solution. But Jesus wants to help you with that. Now notice, once he assessed the mess at the temple, he started flipping over tables and casting out those who were buying and selling there. In other words, he got rid of the things that were dragging them down. So let me ask you this, what do you need to get rid of? I mean, seriously, what needs to go? What are you hiding on your computer? What do you have tucked away in the back of your desk drawer? What memories do you replay over and over in your mind? Maybe to punish yourself, maybe to gratify yourself. Maybe it's poison for you and you know it. Maybe you're treating it as a salve that makes you feel better, but you know and God knows it needs to go. What are those things? See, Jesus did the extreme work of getting rid of what didn't belong, but he went a step further than that. He wasn't finished. Verse 16 of our text says, after he threw the corruption out, it says he would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. In other words, not only did he get rid of what didn't belong, he said, no more. He kept out what was trying to get back in. He got rid of the old, but he also didn't allow new stuff to bring in some of the same old problems. You can't just get rid of what's bad. We have to set up some boundaries so that bad things don't find their way back in. Maybe it's a relationship that you need to back away from. Maybe it's an app on your phone that you need to delete. Maybe it's a magazine subscription that's taking your mind in places it doesn't need to go. Maybe it's a beverage that you can't handle. Maybe it's a group of friends that you can't handle. Maybe it's a job that is causing you to go into all kinds of compromise. Now, all of this that Jesus did was so that God's house could be restored as a place of prayer for all nations. In other words, he didn't just clean up the mess. He restored the place to its rightful purpose. That's kind of the fourth thing here. He restored the place to its rightful purpose. Jesus doesn't want to just clean out your closet. He wants to restore you. He wants you to live in step with him, not in conflict with him. And it's a process. It might be the most important process you'll ever undertake. That's why I said this question could begin a process that would change the course of your life. Because you ask yourself, what's in the closet? That's where it starts. You know, I talked to a guy this week, really great guy. And he feels like he's made a series of decisions the past couple of months that have kind of derailed him from the path he was on toward God. And starts to feel like, man, I'm just too far, too fast, hard to get back on track. And maybe we've all been there. But you know the cool thing about Jesus, the amazing thing about Jesus is that he loves those. That's what he specializes in, is cleaning out closets and restocking shelves. He loves to put things back together. You know, I was working on this sermon and something occurred to me. It's something that I think it's important to understand, I think. Jesus did not die for our sins. He died to save us from our sins. I mean, it's a subtle difference. Follow me on this. Jesus did not die for lust, greed, pride, and selfishness. He died for people who struggle with lust, greed, pride, and selfishness. You see, it's more than just, oh, here's the mess. Let me dive into that. It was because of us, right? Jesus did not die for what's in your closet. He died for you to rescue you from what's in your closet. I mean, does this make sense? Your closet is not the problem. He can deal with that. The problem is the lock that you've put on the door to try to keep him out or to try to keep anybody else out for that matter. Jesus will clean up anything that we give him access to. Jesus will clean up anything that we give him access to. Now you say, well, wait a minute. He stormed the temple. They didn't invite him in. And that's a good point. He took charge even though nobody asked him to. But you know what? The corruption also came right back. It's why ultimately the temple had to be destroyed, because that just wasn't working. The people that ran the temple refused to give Jesus access. It didn't work. And so he had to take the initiative, and he had to step in because he didn't like his kingdom going to hell, and so he was going to step in and do something about it. Jesus forced his way into the temple, and he did that to make a point, but the reality was he couldn't fix it. And so that's why Good Friday had to come, and we'll get to that. Jesus will clean up anything that we give him access to. That's the bottom line. He will clean up anything we give him access to. The Jewish leaders did not give him access to the temple, and maybe that's why God moved out. Maybe God just said, you know what, I need a new temple, and he chose us. Because the ones who were in charge didn't want him in their temple. But Jesus shows us what the process looks like, right? And there's an honest evaluation. What's in my closet? There's that grueling elimination of what's in there that doesn't belong. Then there's that stubborn refusal to let stuff back in. And then there's the return to how things ought to be. Now, there's one last thing I want to tell you about this story, and then we're going to wrap up. All four of the Gospels tell about Jesus cleansing the temple. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They talk about this. Only when Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell about it, it happened on the Monday of Jesus' final week, right? The end of his ministry. When John tells about it, it happened at the very beginning of his ministry, right after he turned water into wine, the first miracle that he performed. So apparently, Jesus cleansed the temple at least twice. Once at the beginning of his ministry, again at the end of his ministry, maybe more, we don't know. But you know what that tells me? Jesus doesn't clean things up and then just bam, it never gets dirty again. He had to go back and he had to clean it up again. A person doesn't surrender to Christ and then they never struggle with sins anymore. No, the battle is a lifelong journey, right? It's why Paul said in Romans 12 that we have to offer ourselves as living sacrifices. You know the problem with living sacrifices? They keep crawling off the altar and they have to be put back on there again, because that's just who we are. So Jesus comes back and he keeps picking us up and he keeps cleaning us up, and he does that because we are prone to relapse. But listen, he will clean up anything that he's given access to, and the access part's up to us. I don't know if you guys have been watching the Olympics much. Man, I love the Olympics. Every 2 years, I look forward to the Olympics. I mean, I do. I just really, really love to watch this. And it's not just the sports. I mean, the best athletes in the world competing for their countries, man, I love that and the pageantry of all that. But it's also the human interest stories, you know, and they give you the backstory, and then you watch these incredible come-from-behind victories, and you see these crushing defeats and how heartbreaking that can be. I was watching a recap early last week of men's cross-country skiing, and I tried to find this video, and I couldn't find the exact video I was looking for, but it was the 30-kilometer long-distance race, and in this little recap I watched, in the first 200 yards of what was an 18-mile course, if you don't know your kilometers and miles, Simon Kruger from Norway and two skiers from Russia, the first 200 yards of the race, get all tangled up with each other, and they end up in this mangled up mess with skis and ski poles and arms and legs flying out everywhere, and they're in a mess. And Kruger comes up, he's got a broken ski pole, so he kind of pushes himself over to the side. His coach brings him another ski pole. He is now securely in last place with 67 skiers in front of him. And I know it's a long race, but he is in trouble. And this recap showed where he was at 5 kilometers, at 10 kilometers, at 15, at 20 kilometers. And he just kept inching his way back into the race. And the first guy across the finish line was Simon Kruger. And he won that race. And it was amazing, the gold medal. I mean, I was just emotional watching this guy gut it out to win that race. Last place to first place. You got some regrets in your life? You got some skeletons in your closet? You got some things that need work? It's not how you start, it's how you finish. It is not how you start, it's how you finish. Jesus will clean up anything that he has given access to. But the access part, that's up to us.